When I was a child, my mother and father lived on different continents. I flew between them. When one was asleep, the other was awake, and the phone rang at all hours. You could never be sure what you heard. Certain phrases were often bent or broken in transit. Complete sentences drifted away and were lost in the exchange. Those that arrived intact would generally mutate over time. Airmailed scrawls in permanent ink proved more dependable, tightly trussed with rubber bands, unable to escape. The words waited immutably in the dark. It's really lovely to be back in Ledbury again, and this is my third reading, but for me the most exciting one. And this is the first time we've performed this show in its entirety. It is a collaboration based on my book All My Mad Mothers, published by Nine Arches Press. And my daughter, Tamar Safra, helped us devise it and also directed it, which when you hear the content of the show will prove to be very apt.
Hi, hello. I'm just going to quickly explain what I'm doing here, because I've got this colourful thing with loads of lights. So, about 2 years ago now, Jackie and I made a piece together where I wrote her some music for cello and piano, and we recorded that in a studio. And so what I've done for this show is to cut up the cello part, which I'm playing here. So this is all music that we've worked together on before. But kind of reimagined, and I think this is quite different actually from that original music, so it's kind of gone on a journey. That's what I'm going to do.
In the winter of 1962, my mother gathered up her baby, her trembling soul, climbed into the mini my father had bought her as penance for his bad behaviour, drove, until she found herself on Hyde Park Corner, travelling round and round in shrinking circles, not sure how to execute the move outwards into another lane, never having been properly taught how to make an exit. Getting into trouble. Mr. Giles said he didn't want the school used as a political jousting ground and made me take the pro-abortion poster down. Although I explained patiently that the ancient Romans didn't mind it, that the church was okay with it in the 13th century until quickening, when they said the soul entered the body, and the statute books condoned it. Michelle, who was a born again, insisted life was ensouled even before conception. Claire believed that once the fetus was viable, it had a right to exist. My mother said she didn't believe in the primacy of the unborn. And I sat in biology wondering if I had a soul, and if I did, where it was. I daydreamed of knitting needles, coat hangers, and permanganate. After my mother came back from hospital, unharmed, grateful, and political, only to find my stepfather had spent all her emergency money on canvases, Carlsberg, and dinner with that woman in the Portobello Road, she sent me straight to the doctor to get myself a Dutch cap. My boyfriend, who was stupid but useful, told all his friends I was a virgin and forced me to see Close Encounters of the Third Kind 3 times and listen to nothing but Genesis, which I preferred to the Sex Pistols because I never believed there was no future, not when my mother was, at least for now, empty wombed and full of soul, not yet tied by blood to the man she loved. Was blonde and clever. She was on my father's arm when he came to collect me for annual holidays. My two fathers did not dislike each other and sat politely conversing on the sofa. One wielded his stethoscope, the other his paintbrush. It was not entirely clear which one of them was in charge. He says he's a Gemini too, always wears white linen to parties and is a recreational heroin user in an open relationship. He whispers, lunch, writes his number on a £1 note, and yes, on a rainy Friday he buys me real champagne at Shiki's, feeds me oysters with his fingers and pays with the dregs of his overdraft. All night, he toys with me, limply but lovingly, on the floor of my childhood room. And when the girlfriend arrives to pick him up the next morning, as arranged, but 2 hours early, and his tongue is confusingly in my ear, it falls to my early rising mother to open the door and offer tea and conversation to the girlfriend, who admires my mother's easy way with the I Ching and spider plants, falls in love with her collection of African beads and new alfalfa sprouter, and, my mother tells me later, is slimmer than I am, with longer hair. This week, that the common bedbug can survive for a year without a meal, and that Alzheimer's may be caused by fast food, which reminds me of David Blaine, suspended in a box above the Thames without so much as a single snack, while people pelted him with sausages and golf balls. How he descended, woozy after 42 days, murmuring, "I love you all," as if he had forgotten. Which causes me to wonder at the hunger and delusions of the loveless, like that anorexic girl who jogs past me every afternoon but never lets me smile at her. Which leads me back intractably to longing and denial. Perhaps perhaps it is something to emulate, the bedbug's stoicism, how it lives reviled and passive in the cracks, waiting with quiet certainty for any fool to lie down in the dark. Jules is the one you go to when you need a place to cry, for example, or hot soup, or fashion advice, Emily says. And while we wait for the soup we've been craving, we ask why death, that common leveller, always comes as a shock. And what if Jules actually dies on the day Emily's niece gets married? What with the niece's mother self-medicating with Seroxat, Somontil, Benzedrine, unable to leave the house, and the father recovering from a triple bypass, Emily might have to give the bride away. Ironic, considering she can't stand the groom who always says Pacific instead of specific and is in recruitment. So Emily's sleepless with worry and obsessing over what to buy from the list at John Lewis, most of it hideous and overpriced, don't I agree? And she's mortified she's even entertaining such trivia at a time like this, with Jules on the seesaw between mindful pain and mindless morphine. So I, in turn, confess I've been wondering what to wear, and would it be inappropriate to ask Jules to trawl Brick Lane vintage outlets with me, just the way we used to, though she may not live to see the day? And as we pause to gasp at those words that just fell from my mouth, here's the soup at last. It's nice if bland, but we're puzzled by the texture of the tofu, spongy, with holes. Emily thinks it may be marinated. I say my vegan son would know. Oh, why is he living on another continent? And we talk about the night he was born. Emily and Jules on their mercy mission to the hospital during my long labour, bearing pizza and ice cubes. The midnight standoff with Nurse Pratt, who threatened them with KY jelly and forceps. And suddenly we're in hysterics. Me doubled up on my wonky wooden chair while Emily salts her bowl with tears. And the waiter stops by to ask if everything is okay. And I want to say, there's something wrong with the soup. But I tell him, yes, it's all perfect. Thank you. Thank you. Late at night, my mother could be found seated at the kitchen table, dispensing lentil soup, judgments, charms, and home truths. Fat friends were exhorted to live on eggs, solitary ones to frequent art galleries and public parks, nervous ones to stand on their heads, plain ones to wear hats. My mother collected their tears in her ladle and used them to season the soup. Mother's bathroom armory. Beehive proppers, backcomb teasers, pinpoint cluck of fearful tweezers, leak of mouthwash, morbid flavour, Dutch cap dusted, snapshot cover, cutting edge of lady razor, glint of sin and lure of danger. Woman's flesh, a fading treasure, braced for pain, but honed for pleasure. Caked on flakes of failed concealer, telltale cheeks of blusher stealer, crimson smear of lipstick wearer, smile expander, mouth preparer, burning bleach and making over, smudged remains of caked mascara, iron clamp of eyelash curler. Usual instruments of torture. Bath brimful of scented water, mother's tricks will pass to daughter. This year, next year, sometime, never. Sicily. The boys show me their penises. Like Chinese mushrooms, but lighter in colour and smaller than I expected, limp and silky in their pleated cowls. So I, in return, present my vagina, whose bald pinkness leaves them unimpressed. The morning's diversion being over, we wander out on the balcony to practice spitting, wave at vespers, local kids and tourists, before we amble down to lunch where Jane, in a caftan, makes her boys drink milk and strokes Rudy's freckled arm as he rages again about Ho Chi Minh and how to get the troops out. Till Minnie, prettiest stepmother in the world, tells a joke about a louse that ends up in the moustache of a motorcyclist who's done something to a young lady wearing a miniskirt and no pants. Jane laments the lack of a record player because they brought Sergeant Pepper, which is fucking revolutionary, and Rudy can't get enough of fixing a hole. Jane and Rudy have a word with their boys about naked bodies on the balcony where anyone might see. My father quickly says how Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is like tripping without tripping. And then Minnie is laughing about the boat, the way my father stopped her climbing the ladder by pinching her left nipple between thumb and forefinger because he knew it made her crazy. And I decide not to tell my mother how I dream the flush of Minnie's breasts, nor offer up the dewy mornings I'm invited to nestle between bodies, the strange and spreading heat of skin, nor talk about those olives stuffed with pimentos, quick salt licks of anchovies, cling peaches furred from the tree, bottles of Chianti breathing, breathing in their modest little basket. Virginity. Why not get it sorted in that lull between O-levels and results, and before I went to Paris for the summer job, where anything might happen? I could consider losing it with Ian, who found me fascinating, ignore his nascent paunch at only 17, forget his parents lived in Boreham Wood. How burdensome, my mother kept saying, to drag the weight of it across the English Channel with all my other baggage. Juliet's Icelandic lover. He floated in through the window on an ice floe pissed as a puffin. I sheltered inside my flannel nightgown like a Victorian chaperone and trembled as he exhaled north wind into the room. While he wrapped you in reindeer furs, you begged me to stay close, whispered you found him repulsive, smelling as he did of Brennivin and Hakari. You shuddered at his ghost-white skin, his hairy face. He was a theatre director from Reykjavik, and you were prim and pretty with a modest acting talent and a long-term boyfriend who was perennially unaware. You were steeped in English waters with your permanent pearls and that neat way you had of sitting with your legs crossed as if to emphasise what lay hidden between them. And you listened through the soft, soft and falling curtain of snow as he pronounced the reasons why you should with him, and why the fat friend who'd never get a man should go back to her room before she broke her teeth with chattering, and how you'd never tried a Viking, had you, Juliet? Never heard the word for fuck in Old Norse. And still I stayed because you asked me to. I even forgave you after I went home to London for a fortnight because of the pneumonia, and came back to find you topless, glowing, perched on that blue, blue glacier, wide enough to span the narrow hall and the flat filled with the smell of him. Putrefied shark, sulfur, crowberry, and ice. My mother shrank to the size of a small potted plant. She sat in the corner clutching her old skates and dispensing strings of aphorisms on the subject of assertion, the broken record technique, and the swinging 60s. There were no buttons left on our shirts. Dust lay in drifts on the skirting boards. My mother was too small to keep up with the housework. Needles frightened her. Mile End. Not like the sight of the inedible fish that lay curled on the plate with its garnish of bright parsley in that bistro in Curzon Street in 1981, when you leaned forward to tell me. More like when we dropped acid and the branches were parsley too, and the fish head sang "Don't You Want Me" through wet mouths, and your face was a moon, then a sun, and your tongue was on my neck with my head bent back in the manner of a Chagall. Not like when I bought oyster mushrooms in Petticoat Lane as an alibi for my mother, and you told me you'd slept with Jude and Louise in some room for hire in Soho. Not like those times you got inside me, once in the attic at Jocelyn's party, one time at least after you married Martha, who always said everything was phenomenal, and once after Grace was born. More like that other time that reminded me of snow. But not like that bistro when, now I come to think of it, you didn't lean towards me, but away. More like that dull Sunday in your hard-to-let flat in Mile End while Martha was feeding the baby in the other room and you murmured, "Sorry, sorry, sorry." One hand on my cheek, one hand on my hand. World's houses. Girls slamming doors mean I am filled with the loss of myself and the brine of myself and the bursting ridiculous shape of myself and the endless embarrassing spill of myself. And what did I break? But boys slamming doors mean only their own reverberant exits in flutters of sawdust putting hinges out of alignment and shaking floors. Girls cry from their rooms, "Come in, I won't let you in, come in." But boys step out onto streets wearing new hard hands, those rackety limbs and sprung joints. Someone has taught them to try all the world's houses. Someone has told them every door is wide open and theirs for the casual slamming.